Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues, Goldman Ruiz, Claire Murphy, Harry Moffitt, and myself, along with our guests, discuss all things Mission Critical Teams. Mission Critical Teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a Mission Critical Team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast.
G'day, everyone. My name's Harry Moffitt, Mission Critical Teams Institute Director for Australia and New Zealand. During the last NFL season, I was lucky enough to speak with Buffalo Bills Head of Performance and Strength and Conditioning, Will Greenberg, a great human being and friend of the MCTI community. During our chat, we talked about his journey through baseball and his passion for strength and conditioning, and the positions he held prior to the Bills from West Point to Utah State. Will has a refreshing and different perspective on human performance, one that I think is emerging across the entire field. I would say it's more of a human-centered approach rather than humans as resources to be deployed for winning, for profit and utilization. We discuss programming now and what it might look like in the future, that it might be more decentralized and multidisciplinary than it already is, less wedded to the science and the scientists, although that's critical. But we might suggest that the science should always be a servant to a good program and never the master. We talk about the importance of struggle in the gym and about flow as something that we know not necessarily conjure up, but something that we are always in and must return to consistently. We also discuss the role and re-emergence of philosophical conditioning in our humans and what that might mean for performance. And Will blows me away with his story of the philosophy booth. In a tough industry, the NFL stands for not for long to many insiders, Will provides a uniquely relaxed perspective with many implications for the Mission Critical Team community.
Will, it's amazing to have you on the TeamCast today, mate. Really appreciate your time. You're in the middle of, coming towards the pointy end of the season at the moment. How are you going and how's the team going?
Everything's going well as we're speaking right now. We just had a game last night and we clinched our division, which is a big, big part of getting to the playoffs and getting a good seeding so that you can potentially have a bye in the beginning of the playoffs, which would be great. But we're on the back half of our season right now. We're 10-2. Like I said, we've clinched a playoff spot and we're just continually trying to be the best version of ourselves, best version of the team that we can be. And see where that takes us.
Yeah, I was saying before, you like to play the underdog, you were saying, but that's, you can't do that anymore. You're the front runners, I would have thought, for the whole competition.
Yeah, the city of Buffalo is in itself kind of like a chip on the shoulder type of city. They've never had a Super Bowl. It's cold, it's snowy, and it's just, you know, you're not in LA or Florida or Miami. You know, you're in a place that it gets gray and it gets cold and it gets tough to live in. So it's kind of like a chip on your shoulder to begin with. And then you start becoming the front runner. And part of that is a figuring out how to operate from a different position, which can be difficult at times. You know, winning solves problems, but also brings new problems. So it's always navigating the complexities and the emerging properties of whatever is. Every season is going to give something new. And this season is, you know, like I said, we're 10-2, and now we have 5 games to play before we even get to the playoffs, and we've already clinched our spot. So, you know, there's always things to navigate. There's always new situations, not just in-game, but just person-to-person, within the teams, you know, just leadership-wise, everything that has to do with being a human being and playing a sport as well.
Yeah, and trying to keep a bit of a lid on it all, not fly too close to the sun and get ahead of yourself. Yanni, I'm a Green Bay supporter, as you might remember, mm-hmm. and there with the cold climate.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to get out and see a major game between two heavy hitting teams. I'd be very happy to do it down south.
After looking
at the game against the 49ers last night. Mate, it's a great season. It's been great to follow you. And because of our relationship, I've got quite a bit of sympathy and I follow the Bills as much as I can. Mate, how did you end up? Just give us a bit of a background to how your journey and how you ended up in the high performance department at the Buffalo Bills.
It's an interesting story and not a usual one, I would say, because I didn't even play football growing up. I played a bunch of sports, but baseball was my main sport. And I came up through high school, played in college, thought I was going to continue to play in professional sports. The scouts and teams had other thoughts on that. So they said, you know, give it a break, try something else. And in that time, in the process of playing baseball, I really enjoyed the process of lifting weights and practice and all that went into performing on a game day. And I figured, well, that seems like a fun thing that I like to do. We had a really good strength coach in college. And I just asked him when I was done, can I intern? Can I just shadow you and see what happens? And from there, I coached in college. I went to a bunch of different colleges. I started at University of Maryland, and then I actually switched into basketball for strength conditioning just out of happenstance at Clemson. Then I went to University of Florida. Then I went to Appalachian State, and then I was at Army West Point, and that's when I switched into football. I was there for a few years, and then I went out to Utah and spent a year at Southern Utah University over the whole department. And just by connecting with the people that I was with, my boss at Army had worked for, at that time, the head strength coach at the Buffalo Bills, who is still the head strength coach of the Buffalo Bills, and they needed
a... So what year is this? What year are you?
This is 2017. I started in 2009, and this is now I've gone to all those places, 2017, and they needed a strength coach who knew about nutrition. Like, I was well versed in nutrition, and I had my master's degree in nutrition, and it just worked out that I knew the right people. I had done a good enough job, and I linked up with the Buffalo Bills. Again, I hadn't even played football. I'd played baseball. I'd worked in basketball. And now, all of a sudden, I'm in the NFL at the highest level. So I definitely could not have imagined being in the NFL at any point in my career. But here I am, and this is my eighth year here and our eighth year as a staff that we started in 2017. And we've been pretty successful. And it's been a journey in and of itself, being in a building for 8 years in the NFL, because you get to see a lot of people grow, a lot of things happen, encounter a lot of different situations. And I think one of the most unique things about being here is that I had to transition going from collegiate to professional. You have to really be aware of your surroundings and understand what your value is and what value you can bring, because developing an 18-year-old is different than getting a 33-year-old to play at the highest level on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So you really have to know your surroundings, know your territory, and update your models of how am I supposed to operate and what value can I bring that's going to help drive the ultimate goal, which is winning football games on a Sunday.
Great, mate. A couple of things in what you just said. So you spent a bit of time at West Point. I'm interested, you know, I guess you were at a different stage, and perhaps even West Point was at a different stage of life and development in terms of, yeah, let's call it human performance or strength conditioning training, et cetera. Were there any major differences that you took away, or do you have any reflections on, you know, the different states, or is the football, Army football, just purely borrowed from the NFL?
A little bit of everything that you asked. I will give the context that growing up, it was one of my goals to go to West Point. I knew the plebe knowledge when I got to Army at that point better than any of the plebes. I knew everything about West Point because I wanted to go there growing up, and I was an Army football fan. So going to work for Army football was one of the greatest honors of my career. And I still hold that in a very high regard, all the people, all the coaches, everyone that I worked with. It was such a cool experience. And with that being said, is you get to see the inner workings of where America's greatest leaders are forged. So I spent majority of my time with the football team, but I also tried to immerse myself with the high performance department. I was on post in the cafeteria, watching how things were being operated, really checking in on the players who needed to gain or lose weight. But you get to see how things work, and you get to talk to generals, you get to talk to captains, you get to talk to a lot of people who have deployed multiple times and understand leadership in a way that I would never be able to just being in sports. So it was cool just to interact with people from all different walks of life and learn from them at that same time. A lot of the leadership, I'll even talk about the leadership part of that is,
yeah, sure,
understanding that these 18-year-olds coming on post had something more important to do than just football. And that to me made me look at how I was meant to lead these players differently. This was not about, hey, let's get you the NFL, let's get you better at football. It was, what life lessons can we learn? How can we translate this to what we're talking about? How can this transcend football? And you started to see a lot of correlations. And, you know, I think the adage of sports being the same as military is, yes, there's some similarities. There's a lot of differences. And I was always aware of where the differences were and what really was, what was important and between the two. But I think the important part was understanding what principles spread across both. And I still maintain a lot of good relationships with the players there who have gone on to be second lieutenants, have gone on to be captains, who are striving to be generals. And we maintain many lines of communication and asking each other questions about how they're handling different situations. What are they reading? What are they learning? What are the things that translate between sports and the military? And I think what I'm trying to say is that leadership piece was really getting to know those people as human beings and seeing where they could develop and how they could think and better make decisions. And it made them better football players. You know, obviously the physical training was something different for football, and then you had to get them in shape for Ranger school or whatever they had to do next. But the way in which they thought and the way they connected with people and the way that they learned how to lead, you got to watch them from a young 17, 18-year-old until they left, 22-year-old, and now, you know, 28, 30-year-old that are making their way into a military career.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a lot of parallels, and I like to allay people in sports their fears. I respect their reverence of the military and veterans, etc. I think that's appropriate. However, I don't mind sports people using terminology like battle and war and gladiator and warrior. I don't mind at all. Some veterans don't like it, and I get that. I'm happy to kind of, you know, entertain both schools of thoughts. But what I would say is I look forward to a day where the military don't have to use it anymore. You know, if humans could only reach a level of sophistication we didn't, but you have to kill each other en masse regularly, then I'd be very happy to leave that terminology with sports and sit in the bleachers and drink beer, to be honest. But that's a bit deeper than we probably need to go, sure. Although I sense we will come back to that. Mate, so just with all that in mind, I asked you, okay, I suppose challenged you in a way to reflect on, you know, what are some of the things that, you know, some of the things that we can, you think military can learn from the civilian domain of high performance, or vice versa, you know, a couple of those types of things. And also, you know, a bit of a current state on where you see human performance or high performance programming at the moment, to give us some insights for our community.
Yeah. And you know, speaking out of somewhat ignorance of what everyone in those fields have to go through and what their experiences are like. But even that preface, I think, leads me into what my point is going to be, is that in sport, one of the things I've noticed is that trying to understand the experience of people is so important to helping them be the best versions of themselves. And there are strategies in which you can optimize a person's performance just because the way in which they are thinking about themselves or the way that they're experiencing the world. And some of that is acute and some of that is chronic. And what I mean by that is, like, in the moment, can you get someone? So for us, it's on a Sunday. Can you get that person performing at the highest level for those 4 hours. But that's also on the shoulders of the work that you've put in over months, a year, of building that person's confidence in their body and their ability to get into that acute state of flow, for a lack of a better term. And a lot of times I think, and I've made, and I won't even say it's a mistake, but I've made the decision that that is purely a physical robotic thing where you look at an athlete, you say, okay, well, I need to get this person from here to here. And you approach it of, okay, they need to, their muscles need to get stronger. Their, like, it's, everything is linear, but really it's just this ebb and flow of where is this person in their life? What are they thinking? Where's their focus? Where's their attention? What is important to them? What values do they have? And what ignites the air? What's the fire that ignites the hot air balloon? And when you can start turning that up, you can really get someone going. So learning about a person, asking them questions, understanding them deeply, helping them take care of things that are unnecessary for them to think about outside of sport. And I know I'm painting a very broad picture, but when you really understand a person, you can get them from point A to B so much easier, just because you lower the friction of them wanting to move for you. You can guide them much easier and they just feel more motivated, like there's a purpose to what they're doing. And the hard part,
you're kind of alluding to what's going on for them off the park is connected to what's going on for them on the park. Is that the connection you mean?
And I think the way I see that is that people are starting to bring their whole selves to work. Where it used to be, you're compartmentalizing that, like, yeah, that's what I do outside of work, and here's what I do inside of work. And I think generationally, that is shifting. I think people are starting to bring their entire selves to, this is who I am all day, every day. And of course, there's shades of gray within that, but I think if previous generations were too separate, like separate those two. And now that you're seeing both of those, it's hard to get someone to perform at a high level if you don't understand what's going on outside the building as well, or outside of sport.
So where do you see, in your mind, the current state of high-performance programming in the NFL? And I wonder if you have any thoughts about where it's heading, or any kind of future shots, if you like, about where the field and approaches to programming are heading, or future developments.
So I can only speak on my experience of what I've seen, what I've done in terms of programming and what people talk about. But I assume that a lot of that is the same looking box. Is you have strength coaches, you have athletic trainers, you have dietitians, you have sports psychologists, you have mental skills coaches, whatever support staff that is needed to support the coaches and players. And so you have the coaches who are calling plays, or they're breaking down film, or they're trying to understand the game of football, and you have the players that are executing the plays and executing the skills. So the support staff has traditionally been obviously in a support role, but it's been almost a la carte of, oh, you need to get stronger, go to this person. You need to improve your mental skills, go to this person. You need to improve your diet, go to this person. You need to get healthy, go to this person. And where I see that shifting, just because there's so many people within an organization that it's easy to get lost, to say, I need to go see these three people, and then schedules may not line up, or something falls through, or you never meet up with that person. And it's just, it's not an ideal setup. So I think that the way in which things are going to go, or that ideally would go, is that you have people that are capable of doing multiple things. Mm-hmm. So a strength coach who also is someone who can help with mental skills and their diet and helping get people out of pain, that are also connected to coaches who understand the game well and the techniques and the fundamentals that need to be drilled, or the physical capacities that need to be practiced or strengthened in order for that skill to be useful in a game. So what I'm talking about is more of a decentralized approach, where there's some agility within, I'm going to holistically take care of you. I, as an individual, Will Greenberg is going, I'm going to holistically take care of these people so that they have everything. I'm a one-stop shop and we can get things taken care of. Now, that doesn't mean that you have a PhD in all of those. You just understand them well enough and you know when to outsource or when to seek different information or a better understanding in order to help support that person and whatever they need. But you can more intimately know those people and handle those people so that they can perform better when the time comes. And they haven't, I really should have been working on my diet, but, I never really got with our dietitian. Or, yeah, I really should have been getting stronger doing this, this, and this. That would have helped with my technique. Instead is that there's less people to have to go through channels of communication, and that just improves efficiency. And I think efficiency in terms of, especially in football, where there's, potentially 90, 100 players and 50 staff, that's a lot of people to have to communicate with and figure out the logistics in order to optimize everyone. And obviously, it's a very difficult thing to scale when I'm talking about holistic care for athletes, but I think ideally it would move towards that way, and then you would figure out ways to either employ more staff or prioritize who is getting what holistic care when.
Yeah, I kind of sense that you've mentioned all of them, but I sense that all the performance programs are kind of based around that biopsychosocial model of what I call human performance, but it's actually out of a model of disease back from the mid-last century. And it's pretty obvious, there's kind of biological, psychological, and social aspects to who and what we are and how we kick around the world. It's interesting, in past discussions you and I have had, and I've had this with others, it's kind of something that's leapt out in the last number of years of sport, is that the strength and conditioning coaches who walk the gyms and the floors really by default already are part psychologist, part kind of anthropologist, in terms of the person's ecosystem, what's going on. The relationships you build with athletes builds the trust that underpins what you're talking about, this kind of multidisciplinary or decentralized. You have strong relationships with a lot of athletes that get you that buy-in, don't you?
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes from, first of all, my own personal curiosity. I'm just curious about people. But I think that there's something about the struggle in the weight room where it's like a shared struggle and a bonding within that, let alone the time that you're with the athletes. So you're with them in the weight room, but you're also at practice, you're at meals, you're on the road, you're really, the only thing you're not doing is most of the time is just meeting with them in their skills meeting. And sometimes you might sit in on those, and those are not really times to communicate or bond with a person anyway. But you have these long stretches of time with another person, and you're helping them go through some sort of buffering physical pain, buffering mental pain, and you're helping them through some of these things. And they end up trusting you because you have given them good advice, or you spend enough time that you've shown yourself authentically consistent with them all the time. And they know who you are, and they can trust that when they show up, they're going to see this person in the gym at this time, and they're going to get the same version of that person. So I think the strength coaching itself is, it starts that way. And then if you are an authentic, curious human being who likes to develop other human beings, you're in a pretty good spot already to say you're probably going to have some athletes that are going to be interested in working with you or spending time with you or developing a relationship with you.
Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah, so I'm sure psychologists are very envious of some of the relationships that you see around the gyms. One of my great inspirations, Percy Cerity, the greatest coach of all time, which is highly arguable, and I look forward to a carton of beer and beating it out. But Percy Cerity, key to his philosophy, his training philosophy, was that you kind of make entrance through the body with the athlete. And that reveals the psychology and their social connection, and then you can kind of work on that. And it's a nice way to look at just building trust. Yeah. And I think there's a certain purity in that low-level suffering. I don't want to make light of suffering, but pain, suffering in the gym, the pain and work, the hard work that goes into it, that does build trust, mm-hmm. that does fast-track trust. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that is. It's very unscientific.
But yeah.
I think there's a truth there somewhere. Going back to teams and this decentralized notion, often in a surgery or a military or a policing or a foreign emergency kind of context, we operate in a crisis moment, so I guess. Mm-hmm. We talk about swarm teams. There is, doctors, nurses, military leaders need to be the generalist, the jack of all trades mm-hmm. and master of none, which is an issue for some leaders to make the transition from specialist to generalist mm-hmm. that leadership demands. And in a crisis, we will swarm those particular specialties to, say, if you imagine an emergency medical team in the hospital and people present at emergency, the doctor of the day will just build a team from mm-hmm. that's available around the hospital. And those teams, interestingly, have never worked together before. They may have met each other for the first right. time and they're about to treat a mass casualty, a very high complex, high consequence environment. So it's an area of interest to Mission Critical Team Institute, mm-hmm. how we team, what goes into the team, and then building trust. But for all those on listening to this, I would commend some of the research that's available online around swarm teams, because we exist in that decentralized state until we don't. And I'm sure that's something that sport may find of interest in how we go about it in those crisis moments. I just want to go back, divert slightly for a moment. You mentioned mental skills. It's a component part. It's come to the fore in the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. We're to the point now where there's the self-help books, shelves are swimming with it. Can you talk a little bit about your experience and the utility and effectiveness of mental skills training and how much has been bought into by the industry?
Yeah. We have a mental skills coach here on our staff. And she's excellent. She does such a great job with piecing together around the culture of football, which has always been, hard and rough. And we don't need mental skills. We're just playing football. And now that landscape is shifting, and I think, again, generationally, I think it's becoming different. Maybe it's the whole self, maybe whatever it is. But being able to develop, she does a great job developing relationships similarly to help understand who people are, unpack how they got to where they are at this point, what has got them to be successful, and then how do they become successful from where they are now. And she and I work together on a lot of different players because we see them in different lights, or we see them in different aspects of the facility. I'm in the weight room with them, and she might meet with them off to the side. But in terms of mental skills for the players that I see here, one thing that I find fascinating is that the lives in which they've led up to this point sometimes create, without them even knowing, their ability to be mentally resilient because of the upbringings they may have had or the challenge they may have faced. Most likely, you're not getting to this point without being mentally resilient in some aspect. So their mental skills, sometimes for me, is figuring out what they're very good at and then being able to help them emphasize that in terms of applying that to what they might be struggling with. A player that might be very introverted or in their own thoughts, they're probably very smart because they spend so much time in their thoughts. Now, how do we get those thoughts out of their head so it prevents them from being clouded? How do we get those thoughts down on paper so that they can remain confident in what they know and what they have and make space for something else so that they can be thinking about the things that they need to be focused on a Tuesday afternoon or a Saturday night or a Sunday at 1 o'clock? A player that has grown up needing to compartmentalize because of going through difficulties through childhood, it's probably a skill that they can go from rep to rep and game from game and deal with failure because they can compartmentalize and put that off to the side and deal with that at a different time. Then it's figuring out how to deal with that in the appropriate manner so that they can learn from it or grow from it and not just, shove it away. And I'm sorry to any psychologists who are listening to this and being like, that's not how psychology works. This is just my anecdote into and my representation of what it looks like for an athlete at the highest level in one of the biggest sports in the world, and people sometimes just trying to piece it together and figure it out.
Definitely.
So it's that's been my experience in terms of mental skills is how can, again, going back to the idea of being the best version of yourself or being, you know, getting into that state of flow per se, is how can I avoid outside noise from interfering with that and helping people navigate around that in the acute moment. And then over the chronic, how do I allow my positives to compound and get me to the point where I can access that acute on a Sunday or in the right moment?
I like it, mate. And I think your challenge to psychologists, or not that you're not doing that, but I'm that's words I'm putting in your mouth, is right. You know, psychology can be a bit anchored and a bit precious about the field. And I think that's appropriate because it's all good until something goes wrong in psychology. And that's always the caution for some people. It's only wafer thin to serious challenges in people's lives. And that's when psychology really comes into its own. The, you know, 7 odd years you spend becoming a psychologist training you to deal with those moments. However, I love the way you talked about people bringing resilience from their background. You know, they bring their own mental models. And one of the areas I'm really fascinated at the moment in psychology is how do we tap into Will Greenberg and work out what models he brings and what do they look like? And do we, is it as simple as getting them on a whiteboard and discussing them, or is it more complex than that? It certainly is complex in the terms of understanding someone's background and how they come. The reverse of that, of course, is people, as you reminded us, can bring mental models that are unhelpful in the current performance environment. So there's a job there to kind of break those down. So I call them the homemade mental models. There's probably a more scientific name for it, but those mental models are really important. And we've, in some contexts, psychologists can be guilty of trying to overlay evidence-based so-called practices, which I don't, you know, I'm not dissing that, onto people's mental, you know, current mental kind of frameworks that don't quite fit or don't quite make sense in their context. So I think there's I see that as the area of growth, which encompasses all of psychology from mental health, psychoeducation, mental skills, psychometrics, the whole field, is how do we mesh those two, the evidence-based models that we know work versus the mental models that people organically bring. And that can be a real issue. And you know, that takes us to discussions about belief. Something that really captured my mind, as you know, I'm quite passionate about the role of philosophy in sports and in programming or high-performance programming. I was thrilled to hear over our discussions that you're the same. But you mentioned that philosophy's kind of made its way into in an explicit way, in a manifest way, into your environment. Did you want to kind of talk a little bit about how that's come about for you?
Yeah, and I'll go back to what I was saying. I'm a very curious person. I just want to know about people and what other people think and what they do. And I'll actually rewind before I even get started on that in the comments you just made about knowing people and knowing their models. I found it so valuable. And again, I'm blessed with the time to spend with people, is that when I just ask people questions, they reveal themselves a lot. And you give them the space to talk about themselves, like I'm talking about myself right now, and they're going to go on. And then being genuinely curious and actively listening to someone and following up with a question about how they felt about that experience or how they handled something and being genuinely interested in what they did and how they got here from there, you learn a lot. Like, you get a context. You'll never truly know the person because, you know, just like you would never truly know a territory from a map, but you can update your map of, well, that context makes that seem a lot more relevant. And when certain things happen, you can draw from that well of information and the context of, oh, this is how this person sees this. This is how they approach X, Y, and Z. And you start building patterns the more you spend time with people, and you can start understanding their models. And then the way that I can help them is by naming those for them that they might not even know themselves. Like, wow, you're very good at compartmentalizing. You're saying that you did this. Well, I remember you said you also did this. It seems like that you're good at this, this, and this. Do you feel like that's the case? And like, oh, yes, I'm pretty good. I guess I'm good at that. okay, well, let's bring that now to this situation that we're struggling with in terms of sports performance and say, why don't we use what you're already really, really good at and apply that? But had I not asked those questions and learned about their life and spent time just asking open-ended questions and letting them talk about themselves, I might not know that piece of information that now I can access and utilize in order to help them with whatever the problem they're trying to solve.
And you might give it a name too, like you'd be right. Like a, you know, right. A model and be able to conjure your, that
that's
up
your superpower. That's what you're really good at.
Correct. Yeah.
And then you can go a million different ways from that. I enjoy doing graphic design now for multiple different reasons, but you can use AI to make someone their own superhero or a comic or, you know, and you use clever ways to help them, remind them about themselves, remind them what they're good at, bring that back all the way around and you know, keep updating their model, helping them update their own models. But that's a whole different discussion. This, I mean, you could just, there's just so much. It's just once you access that world, it's like, it's open land, open territory for just, I'm going to help you in so many different ways. And I'm going to find clever ways to do that. And then again, I was one more point on that is when you go above and beyond by doing something like that for someone, it's in an authentic way without asking for anything in return. It's like, well, this person really cares about me. And now they're going to let on a little bit more about themselves that you might not have known even before that, or they let you into their world, or you see their family, you meet their family. You understand the person so well that you start interacting with them in a way that is just, it's exponentially helpful.
Yeah, I love that, mate. And I said I wouldn't embarrass you, but I will. It's one of the things I've really enjoyed about this very new relationship with you and a few others, I must say, just the open-mindedness and putting that to the forefront, you know, building that relationship. It's just so easy to say, but actually bringing a technical mind to doing that in an authentic way, it's a credit to you. And I think it's a skill or an ability that many listeners, particularly those who are staffing or managing programs that support our operators, athletes, analysts, artists, whoever you want to call it, you know, those skills and abilities are the you know, of the future, those interpersonal skills. You wanted to talk about, wanted you to open up about even more openly about philosophy.
Yep. And I was going there because all of that was kind of the inception of what you and I have talked about and what I call the philosopher's booth. So, you know, every year we have training camp and the Buffalo Bills, we go away to a place called St. John Fisher. It's a college about an hour and a half from our facility. And it's just a way of, again, shared suffering and bonding, you know, shared struggle is you go back into a college dorm and you stay there but you spend so much time with each other because that's, you have nowhere else to go. You have nothing to do. So you're meeting and practicing. They're long days and people just, it's a 3-week, 4-week long job interview. And that job interview is painful and it's long and it's hot and it's, they're being critiqued on everything you do. In football, everything is filmed, and then you just go frame by frame, okay, this is why this is wrong. This is why this is wrong. This is why this is wrong. Granted, they do a lot of good stuff too, but, you know, as coaches are generally going to try to fix the errors that are wrong, and you're interviewing for a job while all this is going on. Now you have to go back out and perform, and it's difficult, you know, but that's what the job is. So with that being said, at night, people like to hang around and stay in the cafeteria, and they have really good food at this college. But the food is so good that we had a couple players come in a little too heavy at the beginning of training camp. And so there's the seats inside the cafeteria, and you know, when you're walking into the cafeteria and you can smell the sugar, salt, and fat of just all this delicious food. You know, there's options on options. There's a, you know, any type of cuisine that you want. And so those couple players it was requested that they not enter the cafeteria because it's very easy to overeat. And there are these booths outside of the cafeteria, you know, but there's also these big glass bay windows. So you're just kind of looking in like, man, I wish I could be in the cafeteria there. But me having empathy for these players, I'm thinking to myself, man, these are grown men. And now I have to sit out and patrol, make sure that they're eating appropriately and that they're losing weight. I feel badly that these alpha males are going to be put in that situation. So in my head, I thought, okay, well, I need this to happen. I need them not to be going in there and overeating. I'm going to bring them their meals. However, it would be cool if, you know, a couple of the cool kids from the team came out and sat out there, like their comfortable booths come out there. So I went to a couple of the veterans and said, hey, come out here. Just why don't we eat out here today? Try something new. And so they did. And, you know, that was the first day. And the second day, one other person. The next day, and another person. And little by little, it became popular to sit over at the booth. And it never had been vilified as like, oh, all the fat guys sit over here. It was just, hey, we're trying something new out here. And one by one, people started coming over. And then all of a sudden, you know, a few weeks into camp, there are people are fighting for seats. People are rushing up to dinner so they can get a seat. They're pulling up chairs. There's 20 guys sitting around. And the best part about it, and how this became known as the philosopher's booth, is we'd sit there all night and we'd talk about the widest ranges of things you could ever imagine, from the existence of God to the trolley problem to lavish parties they've had, or talk about marriage or females, or, you know, you can just add the range of topics was whatever sparked anyone's interest. But it would be just argument after argument of, you know, conspiracy theories, or, you know, like I said, religion, politics, nutrition. And I'm sitting in the middle of this and I'm like, whoa, this is kind of cool information. And I was able to kind of mediate a lot of the conversation, but it became so popular. And, you know, this is, let's say 4 or 5 years ago. Every year we've gone back, people are like, hey, we're going to the booth, and just became known as the booth. And people go back and, you know, people take a picture when we leave, like, hey, I hope to see you next year. And it became almost an identity of that you were at the booth, and everyone had their seats. You know, the old heads, the veterans are like, hey, I sit right here in this booth. That's my seat. So anyone's there, you get out. And what ended up happening is the amount of conversations I had about morality and evil and God and people's understanding of what politics is and what government should be. I could go on and on and on of all so many different perspectives of people. And you just sit back and you listen. And you listen to someone talk for 5 minutes about what they believe, how the role of a government should be. And, you know, ignorant or not, or whatever their experience was in life, you just got to learn about that person and see their viewpoint. And, you know, someone would chime in, they'd argue or they'd agree, or, you know, there's just so many perspectives of the people sitting around, and everyone, there's white, black, young, old, you know, coaches would come sit down, staff members would come sit down, and it would, you know, people wanted to experience the philosopher's booth, and there would just be these like deep into the night conversations. And, you know, you'd have like parts of the booth that would section off and be talking about this, and this part's talking about this. You just never knew what you were going to hear or what you were going to talk about. You know, some of the funniest stories I've ever heard were at that booth. And then some of the most meaningful conversations I've had with people were also at that booth. And why does that matter to a football team is like, there's something to gravitate towards. There's an identity of that's what we did. And we learned about each other and we bonded all through the you know, the shared struggle of camp. But it was almost a reprieve of, all right, now it's time to talk about existence. Now it's time to talk about McDonald's and why I should eat McDonald's. And it's like something stupid like that. It was one of the cool experiences in my career so far. And every year we go back there, we'll continue to go to the booth. And it's one of those things that we can talk about through the year. Like the students at that school probably have no idea that, you know, some Hall of Fame athletes were sitting there talking about the trolley problem and the things that, yeah, that were discussed there. It was just amazing. It's something that's pretty cool.
I think it's an area that I see more and more, maybe because I attend or my eyes are open to it. But you talked before brilliantly, and it's something, a note I've taken down on a notepad here, about people bringing all of themselves, mm-hmm, to work, to the workplace, or to, mm-hmm, the sport, to the team environments. I think that's a really key takeaway. But who would have thought that athletes or operators thought deeply about things, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you give them the space to, you know, a safe space, I don't mind using the word. I know it makes some people bristle, but I don't mind using it, you know, spontaneously availing people to, mm-hmm. to think those deeper thoughts and talk about them. A lot of operators and athletes that I've worked with or built relationship with might be embarrassed to talk about these things or embarrassed to bring them up, or there's stigma about looking intellectual. You know, there's an anti-intellectual thread in a lot of our environments because people don't want to look smart, you know. I don't know what that is. It's a strange thing. But the philosopher's booth, mate, I remember when you mentioned that a month or so ago when we were chatting, it kind of jumped out as a great example of, I think, what's going on behind the scenes as these new generations come through. The key for this is that I think there are spaces where it's non-transactional, not performance-related. Mm-hmm. People can let their shoulders and chins drop just a mm-hmm. little bit and relax and breathe out and just be themselves in environments of high intensity at the top flight of high performance, so-called. I think this is really important. And I'll go even further and say it's profoundly important because at some stage these humans have to return to the world. Mm-hmm. They have to go home to the village. They leave their village at 16, metaphorically, off to war, sport, medicine, whatever the case may be. But eventually, no matter who you are, even the biggest Patrick Mahomes, the biggest legends have to go home at some stage. The party's over and the lights go off. And I think the philosophy or a philosophical element to high-performance environments is an answer to that transition problem. Not all of the answer, but part of the answer. Can I ask you to talk maybe a little bit about the transition journey of athletes? Not every athlete, I imagine, sitting or enduring that job interview makes it to the end. You know, how while we're on it, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a solved problem there. But I will say a lot of these guys have grown up being the best at what they do, and they've gotten what they want because of doing those things. So you could see where someone entrenches their identity into, well, I play football, I'm a football player, or I do this, I play this sport, I get things because of that. I get money because of that. I get friendships because of that. I get access because of I am a football player. And that's what I'm valuable with. That's what I'm good at. That's where I bring value without thinking, oh, this is going to end, or at least in the, you know, it's okay, it's going to end someday, but not right now. And if you were to get to the end of your career out of, you know, hard work and luck and all the things that go into it, and you're 35 years old, and you've never thought about in your life, how else can I bring another person value, or how can I bring the world value? That's a tough transition. That's a tough transition to say, okay, well, I'm done. I've been discarded. People are not paying attention to me on a daily basis like they always have. I've always gotten things because I bring value in this way. I don't have that value anymore. It doesn't matter if it's sports or anything else. That's difficult. And every single one of these players in professional sports, their careers are going to end long before someone in the real world, you know, and the people that actually work for a career in their entire lives up until retirement at 70, you have another 35 years of life now. What are you going to do? And you could see why people may struggle with that. And so it's a hard thing to do in the moment to remember that you bring value because you're so good at this, but also don't forget you're also a valuable human being. Let's work on that valuable human being as well. Or what I try to do with athletes is, what is it about football that you love? What are the things that you value about what you do, and what are you good at? So you might be, yes, physically skilled, but are you someone who thrives in this environment because you interact with teammates in a way that makes them better? Or are you someone who loves the jigsaw puzzle of trying to figure out a defense and an offense, and you are able to use your mind in order to be successful? Like, what are the things, what are the components, what are the principles that make someone successful at football that can be translated into another world at some point in your life. And let's continue to cultivate and use those words and name those things of being really, really good at that. I have one athlete that sees the world. He says he experiences the world in like drop down menus. That's how his brain works. So he remembers the playbook in drop down menus. So I made him a playbook because he's so good at understanding a playbook for life skills. Okay. With relationships. What is a playbook for, like, this is the way in which you operate. Here's the scientific information of that. And here's how it looks. That's the play. If you have, so every situation that comes up, we add to the playbook of, okay, you're having misalignment with your wife. What are the components about misalignment that brings conflict? What are the ways in which, what are the strategies now in which you can realign with those things? What are the issue? Like, you know, every play has something that can beat it. So what are the things that might beat this play? Oh, your ego might beat this play. Your inability to see another person's perspective. Like all those things, knowing that person, I can create that playbook and help, you know, have that strategy so that, you know, I'm not going to be with this person my entire life, but they have it in a drop-down menu for themselves. Other people like to do things more ad hoc, and it's just, you know, their life is chaotic and you're just helping manage the fire hose and trying to distill that for them and help solve problems by, you know, feeding information back to them of how they see things.
Percy Sterity would say that it seemed not to make sense to him, I'm paraphrasing him here, that you would just focus on the technical skill and the character traits required to, he was a running coach, you know, at one stage he owned all of the middle and short distance world records and gold medals in the world through his athletes, his stables, his Stoughtons, as they were called. And to him, it just didn't make sense that you focus only on the transactional skills, abilities, or just those character traits that require to run a mile. You know, that was the biggest show in town back in the day. And he said, why wouldn't you start from building the human first? And surely if you appreciate as much as you can of the whole human, the character, the you know, and that this comes down to the philosophical base as a starting point for him, then surely inside of that you've got the optimal, I hesitate to use the word, human athlete or performer. Yeah. And I think that's a completely different way of looking at it than I see in the world of high performance sports and special operations, where we tend to just focus on the parts of the whole to facilitate the outcome, which is winning, profit, progress, whatever it may be. It's not to say that's a bad thing. It's just that I think it may be remiss, or the future of kind of these programs is being more holistic.
Yeah,
but to the extent of philosophically being holistic.
I do think there's something, you know, the All Blacks better people make all better. All Blacks, right? Is that the saying? And sometimes I think there's even more context to that. There's more nuances. Like, you could take a very morally sound human being and they're still not going to be good at football if they're not good at football. But by understanding what unique value that person brings to the world in a way of good character and a positive nature in what they're good at, then you can emphasize that. And it's not just better people, but it's a better version of that person. And then when I say, you know, the best version of someone, that's really what I'm saying is, like, by knowing someone deeply and intimately and saying, I know that this person brings this value and they're skilled at that. And it resonates with the situation. I think they're like, the idea of resonance is one that always sticks out in my mind, is like, you can be good at X and it doesn't fit with the Y situation. But it's like, if this person's really good at this and it brings value to this situation, how do we really emphasize that and utilize that skill where that person also feels fulfilled and important and valued by that skill? That's the ultimate goal that I see of, like, making a better person, that makes a better football player or athlete. But you can't just approach it as, this person needs to be better at this skill, or like, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a robot that we're just trying to fine tune. It's like exploring the intricate parts of the machine and knowing that it's just, it's all over the place and it's free flowing and it's an autonomous agent. Like, and then being able to understand that and feel, and I'm not this type of person, but I always go back to the idea of just like vibration and resonance with whatever they're doing. Like, you know, when you see someone in flow, or when you see them doing the thing they love and doing it well and having fun, you're like, that's where that person thrives. And then you feed that information back to that person and you figure out what it is about that situation that they love. And you just ask them questions and then you just keep pulling on that string. When you really name that, I guarantee that that's something beyond sports. Mm. And you help them find something that they can sink their teeth into little by little as they're still playing sports. Even like if it's just being a part of a team, well, where else can you find being a part of a team and communicating with other people? What business is that in? What does that look like? What is it definitely not in? And avoid those things. And they can start their new journey after football or after sports into being able to do that. But it takes time to really like some introspection of what am I good at and what resonates with me so that I can try to replicate that. And what's my next mountain that I have to climb?
Yeah, well, with people like yourself, mate, and you're not alone, and I think it's a growing area of understanding, you know, treating the whole human and not just the parts. It doesn't mean either or kind of prospect. It's we can chew gum and eat at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, and walk at the same time. However, I think in terms, you know, from a military perspective, from my perspective, one of the biggest challenges we have is transitioning the operators after, you know, some pretty extreme experiences in special ops and some pretty extreme demands that we place both cognitively and physically and without exception socially on families, etc. The word transition started to sit uncomfortably with me. I think we can learn from sports in tapering people in and out of these. We know where they're headed. We know the trajectory. We've learned from thousands and thousands of data points and other operators. And it's what we do along the way to support them, that can set them up, not waiting to the end and then helping them out, because that's the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. I think it's much better place at the top. And I think we in special ops and sports have something that we share in common, and that is that it could all be over tomorrow. And mm-hmm. that your life is on hold, that mm-hmm. that's your education, your personal development, your networks. You know, some by the time you're 40, professional people have built huge networks that support them professionally and mm-hmm. personally in a lot of sports and special ops, I think, are similar in that those networks for the majority, not the privileged, not Patrick Mahomes, or not privileged, but the lucky, mm-hmm. you know, the ones that make it all the way. And so, you know, at 30, coming out of a system you've been in for 15 years, and that goes for the military as well. If you have an injury, for example, or you're just mm-hmm. not picked, you know, a good corporal doesn't make a good sergeant, doesn't make a good warrant officer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you do have ceiling ranks mm-hmm. or ceiling limits beyond which you don't progress. But what do you do next? What does Will Greenberg, where does he move on to from the Buffalo Bills after hopefully a championship in a few months' time?
I was talking to Preston Klein one time, and he actually said this, and it kind of flipped the way I looked at things. You know, like, I'm a strength coach, and that doesn't seem like, okay, you can't really do much from that as a strength coach. And he said something along the lines of, you're a person working in human development. And I was like, that perspective is so important to me. And it's similar to what I was just talking about with what people are good at, is like, mm-hmm. as long as I am developing, helping develop or interacting, connecting with human beings and fulfilling a purpose in some capacity, I'm great with whatever I'm doing. As you know, if that can support my family and my family is fulfilled as well, and that's all part of it, is I'm happy doing whatever it is that challenges my mind. I get to connect with people, I get to help people, and I get to see things through. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Rudy.
Yep.
And towards the end of the movie,
that's a really popular, that's a legendary American movie,
yep,
isn't it?
Yep. And most people think of, when they think of Rudy, they think of success of being carried off the field. And yeah. there's a character in that, and he's a groundskeeper, and he helps him navigate almost as like a mentor, as a guide throughout that. And in the scene where Rudy is being carried off the field, it pans to him and he's standing outside the stadium and he just claps and he's like, yes, you know, the guy did it. And he just walks away. And to me, that scene, I want to be the groundskeeper in that. That's how I see it. Like that I made an impact in that person's life. They were wholly successful in what they did. They accomplished what they wanted. And I'm going to go back to doing that again. And that's really that scene always resonates with me. Is like, what's next is, I don't know, but I'm going to do that. And I'm going to continue to do that. Right now I'm doing it in the NFL and it's fulfilling and it's fun and it's enjoyable. But yeah, the NFL stands for not for long. And it's, you know, everything comes to an end. And I hope that I'm able to do this for a long time. But in the case that I'm not, as long as I'm helping develop people and helping other people succeed and investing myself into other people, I'll be solid.
No, I fucking love that, mate. I'm with you. I think there's nothing more satisfying than knowing you've contributed to someone else's you know, journey in the world that's made them happy and fulfilled. And when you said that, I thought I'm on board with groundskeeper Willie. I think
that's right.
It's a wonderful way to look at it.
And my red beard, you know.
Yeah. The metaphor is wonderful as well, mate. I think life as leaders or elders, if you like, or as stewards of humans. We are gardeners. We can't make them grow, but we can kind of set the conditions in which they can grow in the best possible way, or the great growth potential. Mates, I can't let anyone go without asking what you're reading, what you're listening to, any great podcasts or books, anything you've picked up on that you think are really helpful in this domain.
I love asking people the same question. And I have my list. I had a think about what I'd want to say here. But so I have a few books that I'm gonna say. Probably a couple are popular, some other not so popular. My favorite book of all time is called Learning from the Octopus. The author's name is Rafe Sagarin. I think I'm saying that correctly. And he was a marine biologist who was contracted by the NSA after 9/11. And he applies the world of marine biology into terrorist networks, into how complex things work. And he draws these beautiful parallels between like the world of tide pools and the patterns of, you know, terrorist networks and security systems and things that have to do with national security, which you would never think would correlate. But it's the understanding of complexity and how emergent properties come to be. I've read it 10 times and I have all my notes in there. And then there's a book called Sense Making, The Power of Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. And that was recommended to me last year. And I really enjoyed that idea. And a lot of my ideas of like resonance and things that, and how to interact with other human beings to have meaning. I really enjoyed that book. And then there's a few more popular ones. Super Communicators was a book that I read recently that I thought was excellent. I felt like that book was explaining a lot of the things that I was doing or trying to do with the athletes that I work with. So I really enjoyed reading that. And then I've been rereading The Great Mental Models by Shane Parrish, volumes 1-4, and trying to apply those and try to understand what those models look like in my world. And then podcast-wise, I'm a big Morgan Housel fan, so Same as Ever is another really good book, but I listened to that podcast, The Knowledge Project, Shane Parrish, same thing. And then there's one called Acquired that I really like. It's just an exploration of how businesses were founded and created and how they came to be. There's one, actually, if you want to listen to, about the NFL that I think is the most... I learned more about the NFL in that three-hour podcast than I did working for 8 years. It's very, very good.
So that's the Acquired podcast, NFL.
Yeah. Acquired is a podcast, and then that episode of NFL. And then one of my mentors was a Australian high performance director for GWS Giants. He part of a podcast called One Track Mind that I think is a very interesting look at the world of sport and the complexities of it and human behavior, decision making. Sam Robertson and David Joyce is my mentor. And then anything that has to do with human behavior, Adam Grant. There's one called Smart People Podcast. So those are some of the ones that I'm listening to. And anytime I'm not working, I'm at my earbuds in or a book in front of me, and I'm just trying to absorb information. So those are some of the ones that I've been paying attention to recently.
So, mate, well, thank you for that. There's a great list there, and I, as always, encourage people to build your own library, have it proud at home, somewhere you walk past it every single day. It doesn't have to be Jefferson size. It can be a humble couple of few hundred or a couple of dozen. But I think your library tells you a lot about yourself. It tells you about your bullshit. You know, the books you buy, you never read, but they're just up there because they look good. Your library's full of books. It should be full of books that you haven't read to remind you that you can't know it all and that you should make more time for reading. And then the thing I love about libraries and books is that, in a way that I don't think technology will never be able to do, is that in a whole side of a wall, which is better than a piece of art, I think a bunch of books is much better looking, books can speak to you. They can just grab your attention and you just pick it, and it might be something you read, you haven't read, and you graze on that book. Sometimes I find that's one of the most magic moments, is when a book just speaks to you out of the library or out of the bookshelves and says, hey, come and read me. And that spontaneity is something that we more and more missing. Hey, Will, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. I really appreciate you making time.
Appreciate you.
I noticed that, and I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation. I'm looking forward to catching up. Hopefully next year I'll be across for the MCTI summits, and I'll drop by for that beer that you owe me, or that I tell you that that you owe me. I'm just looking at the roster now, or the fixtures now. You've got the Rams next at home, so I hope it's nice and cold for those Californians, and you know, not too long to the playoffs starting, mate. And I wish you all the best. I'm as I said, a closet Bills fan now, and we actually had a bit of an issue with getting NFL games here in Australia. The channels are going to war over rights and all this type of stuff. So it's not as good as it's been.
Now, listen to the Acquired podcast. You'll learn more about that.
Yeah, mate, that's going straight to the top, because I've got to be honest, I'm a little bit sick of human factors stuff just at the moment. I'm finishing another book, so I love the NFL. It's the biggest show in town, you know, it's the saving grace at the end of the AFL season here. The NFL starts up, so you don't have that kind of, you know, let down if you're into NFL. Yeah. So, but no, thank you very much, mate, and I wish you, the team, family, and life all the best, and thanks for being on the Mission Critical Team Institute Teamcast.
I appreciate it.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's Janese at missionCTI.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.